The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Be seated, please.
Well, we're already off schedule and off the page. Unfortunately, a few moments ago, Chief Justice Moyer developed a problem with his hip. He had hip replacement surgery not long ago, and so he developed an issue, and he will be participating in all of these cases. He has read all of the briefs. He'll be able to see all of the arguments that the lawyers present, and will assist in deciding the cases. Before we begin, just a word about the off-site court program. We appreciate the cooperation of the litigants and the lawyers in this learning experience that the chief established years ago when he first became Chief Justice. And this is, I think, what, the 52nd or 53rd, 52nd county for the court to visit. We now do it twice a year, spring and fall. The purpose of that is to allow students to see the Supreme Court of Ohio in their home communities, and also for the lawyers and judges in those communities to have an easier chance to see the court up close and personal. And we want to thank today Judge Ken Spicer, Teresa Tackett, and Sue Catterman, who were the coordinators, Judge Duncan Whitney, who is in whose courtroom we are residing at the moment, and the rest of the Delaware County judges and court staff and volunteer, and the Bar Association and the educators who have assisted the students in trying to understand the cases that are going to be presented today, and the Delaware County commissioners for making this program available to us. There will be about 500 students watching this court session today. Not all of them, obviously, are going to get into the courtroom, and the rest will see it through live streaming in sites available here. And the chief wanted us to mention the total number of students since 87 that have been able to see the court in their home counties is over 22,000, and the total number of students and adults over 30,000. So it is a small outreach program, and as the lawyers know and students who asked this morning, now due to technology, if your teacher will let you out of class, you can actually, if this has whetted your appetite, you can see more of the court online, live, through the technology that's available on your computer. With that, the first easy case for the students to understand is Dugan and Myers versus State of Ohio Department of Administrative Services, 15 minutes per side, and the appellants, represented by Michael Curry, will begin.
Thank you, Justice Pfeiffer. May it please the court, I am Mike Curry with Thompson Hine here on behalf of the appellant, Dugan & Myers Construction Company. With me today at council table is Pete Willeen, who is trial counsel in the case. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time. The court has before it what will prove to be the seminal case that will prescribe the rights and responsibilities of those who participate in Ohio's construction industry in the future. The parties agree on one point. This case has dramatic implications for the sanctity of the public bidding process in Ohio. The parties are, however, at polar opposites on how that sanctity is best protected. To understand the gravity of the court's decision, In the view of Ohio's $17 billion a year construction industry, the court need only look at the 44 constituents of the amicus curiae that support reversal of the 10th District Court of Appeals decision in this case. The Court of Appeals decision with respect to the application of the implied warranty of the specifications represents a radical departure from existing Ohio law. If this court were to affirm the Court of Appeals decision in this case, Ohio would be out of step with every other jurisdiction in the country. If this court were to affirm the 10th District's opinion in this case, it will be devastating to the construction industry in Ohio, both on behalf of owners and the other participants in the process.
Counsel, are there issues of waiver that take this out of such a dire consequence?
I'm not sure I understand your question as it relates to waiver.
Or contractual issues that take this out?
No, I don't believe that there are, Your Honor. The state has made several arguments that I suppose one could view as waiver. Are you referring to the provision in the contract that requires bidders to review the plans
right.
in advance of bidding? That is pretty inopposite to every decision on that point across the country. The public owners, pursuant to 153, the legislative mandate of 153, are required to provide plans and specifications that are complete. Specifically, 153, and I think it's worth quoting some of the language from 153. It says, full and accurate plans and specifications are to be prepared. The bidders have to be able to rely upon what's in the plans and specifications. Subpart D says that the owner must prepare definite and complete specifications of the work to be performed together with directions that will enable a competent mechanic or other builder to carry them out and afford bidders all necessary information. It was clear that the legislature understood that at time of bidding, the plans need to be complete so that the bidders are all bidding upon the same thing. Now, let's keep in mind that public owners, in this case in point, had 2 years to work with their designers to prepare the plans and specifications. The contractors had 4 weeks to bid this job. Now, let's put that in practical application. The architect prepared a matrix. There were 732 requests for information that that Dugan & Myers issued on this project, asking for clarification of the plans. In response to those 732 RFIs, the architect issued 1,000 supplemental drawings. There were only 400 drawings in the original bid set. Now, you have 4 weeks to bid this project. As a practical matter, it took a year and a half for the architect to get these plans cleaned up. These charts, and there are 15 of them, one for each floor of the building. Every one of those red dots, yellow dots, represents an error in the plans and specifications where there was a supplemental drawing issued.
Counsel, when were the supplemental drawings prepared?
Over the course of construction.
So over the 2.5 years?
That's correct. Essentially in the last year and a half, because the first year of construction went along fairly well.
Okay.
When they moved to the interiors, what had happened was there was a lack of coordination of the mechanical, electrical, and plumbing drawings with the architectural and structural. What you ended up with in the interstitial space between the ceiling below and the floor above, inadequate space. You had, for example, pipes that were shown to go essentially right through structural I-beams. Now, you can't pick that up in just a simple review of the drawings because you've got different disciplines. And we're a multi-prime contracting state. The electrician is looking at his drawings, the plumber is looking at his drawings, and that coordination effort is what's called coordination drawings that is typically done during the course of construction. That's when that comes up.
So you would classify these 200-plus changes as being significant and not just inconsequential or minor?
Absolutely. A perfect example is the one I just gave. Mm-hmm. What is the contractor to do when you show a pipe going right through a structural I-beam?
What did the contractor do?
They sent in an RFI and said, what would you like us to do with this? It doesn't work.
And then it was redesigned.
Then it was redesigned.
And then you performed according to the redesign.
Then performed according to redesign. And that happened hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times on this project. This type, the pervasiveness of the design errors on this project is not typical to construction.
Is there any dispute that the litigation is based on the delays that your client says were caused by the defective design?
That is correct.
That's all it's about is damages that your client claims they incurred as a result of the delays caused by design defects.
Yes, that is true. There are certain facets to that, the liquidated damage issue being one, and the takeover contract with Gilbane being another, that get into what was the cause of the delay, who was responsible for it. So it is multifaceted, but yes, the principal tenet of all of this is delay to the project as a consequence of 732 RFIs, 1,000 drawings.
Now, your client, am I on?
Excuse me a minute before we go on. In my effort to explain why the chief wasn't here, I absolutely forgot to explain that Justice Resnick, who will be retiring from the court at the end of this year, has, in an effort to accommodate our workload so that we aren't having to rush your case or others out the door before the end of the year, has decided to recuse from the cases we're hearing this fall. And sitting in her place on this case is Judge Carla Moore from the Ninth District Court of Appeals. So we're happy to have Carla Moore sitting here in place of Judge Resnick. Go ahead.
Thank you.
And we won't charge you time for that.
Okay. Thank you for that, Justice Pfeiffer.
I understand your position is that this is a dramatic change in case law, but the other side argues the contrary, that if this case is overturned, that it will be a dramatic change for all of the government entities that contract. And their basis is that your client did not put any, except I believe there was one change order, request for delay in writing. Your defense is, well, it was a vain act. They wouldn't have given it to us anyway. But you know our court has been very strict in enforcing terms of contract, and the contract clearly required your client to put requests for delay changes in writing. Now, the concern I have is if we do affirm, what happens to the case law in that area, and do they have a valid point in that they will be surprised at the nth hour by all of these delay charges when they never were notified in writing as the contract required to extend the contract because of delays. How do we deal with their concern in affirming this case if we do so?
Well, I think that's a very good question. The answer to that question is that we can stay in the mainstream with the majority of other jurisdictions that clearly accept the doctrines of constructive and actual knowledge, where it can be demonstrated that there was no actual prejudice to the owner from a lack of formal notice. One would have to completely ignore the record in this case to conclude that the university, its construction manager, and the associate architect did not have actual knowledge of the delays on this project.
But even if they had actual knowledge, you still failed to fulfill your contract requirement to put it in writing and put the request in writing.
I don't believe that that's an accurate assessment.
Well, did you put it in writing?
What is a writing?
Did you put it in writing?
Yes.
How?
Carol Bankert was Gilbane's representative on the project. In September of 1998, she created a meeting agenda for a meeting with the contractor and the state to review the problems with the schedule and the delays that were occurring. Her notes from that meeting reflect the discussion of time extensions being needed on this project. In October, there were meetings and meeting minutes that reflect that discussion.
So you argue that minutes are your notice in writing?
The purpose of written notice is to let the owner know that there are issues that are going to require either a time extension and or compensation. There are multiple writings on this project, and referee Clark specifically found that the evidence was overwhelming that the university knew about the problems. In fact, it was so pervasive that in February of 99, after Dugan and Myers issued a new schedule update reflecting that there was going to be substantial delay to the project, the university had internal meetings to do, in their words, damage control. And part of that damage control was to write what they called happy camper letters to the contractors. Can we, on that record, conclude that the university, the construction manager, and the associate architect didn't have actual knowledge that this project was being delayed? They got copies.
So you would have us write a principle of law that says actual knowledge excuses the written notice required by the contract.
Where there is a showing of no prejudice, what was the university going to do different if they got a one?
Why isn't it just easier to go ahead and put it in writing so every party knows and there's no litigation to determine what was actual knowledge?
How does the contractor do that when faced with 732 RFIs and 1,000 new drawings? Is that 732 letters, 1,000 letters? I mean, we have to, we can't look at this in a vacuum. We have to deal with it in terms of this. These are complex construction projects. There are weekly meetings. There is plenty of, everyone knows what's going on. For the university to suggest that they didn't have knowledge that this project was being impacted by delays caused by 1,000 new drawings being issued by the associate architect is ludicrous. They're involved in this project. They have a construction manager who was one of the largest in the country involved in this project. It defies logic to suggest that they didn't know this project was being delayed, that they didn't know it was impacting the contractors. In fact, Accurate Electric, as early as February of 99, started sending letters with notices of claim. Is that knowledge going to be segregated and apply only to Accurate? Can we really expect the university to say, well, we know it's impacted as to Accurate, but these other prime contractors, we don't know? The reality is, had this been one fundamental problem that delayed this project, perhaps the university could have claimed prejudice and said, had we known, we would have done something differently. But here, every day, every room of that building was delayed because of some problem with the drawings. The reality is, at what point in time do you know you've been delayed? How long? You submit an RFI. Do you know how long it's going to take the associate architect to issue an answer, to give you one of those 1,000 drawings to fix the problem? At what point in time does it become cumulative enough that you say, okay, now I know I'm impacted? Why didn't the university recognize that there were impacts when they got a new schedule in February of 99 that said this project is delayed 6 months?
The Court of Appeals ruled against you on two or three specific assignments of error. Do you want to take a moment to address exactly where you feel they went wrong and to also fold in? There are some issues. If we were to rule in your favor, there are still disputes as to the level of damages, are there not?
Well, sure. Let me take a stab at responding to that. Let me approach it this way. The state and the supporting amicus argue that public policy should dictate that the 10th District's interpretation of the implied warranty be affirmed. I mean, that's what we're really here about, is the interpretation of the implied warranty. They make the impassioned plea that to do otherwise will subject the public treasury to looting by contractors. First, I should point out that this hasn't happened in 100 years since Spirit. The public treasury has not been looted. It has to be acknowledged that this public policy consideration is present with respect to every state's treasury and the federal treasury. The Federal Circuit Court deals with all the federal cases affecting construction, as do the boards of contract appeals. There's no other state or federal court that has adopted the 10th District's interpretation. The Federal Circuit hasn't. The boards of contract appeal haven't adopted it. So what the 10th District and the state and the amicus are arguing is that they are the only ones out of all that jurisdiction that got the interpretation of Spirin right and got the application of the implied warranty of the plans right.
How do you see Spirin applying in this case?
Spirin and its progeny are consistent with 153.01 of the revised code. When the owner publishes a set of plans and specifications, the bidders are entitled to rely upon the accuracy of those plans and specifications. And if there are defects in those plans, the contractor is entitled to recover for the costs resulting from those defects. The Court of Appeals decision in this case says the implied warranty doesn't apply if there are hundreds of defects in the plans that don't make building the building impossible. But if there's one that makes it impossible, then it applies. We either have the Spirin implied warranty of the plans and specifications or we don't. It either exists or it doesn't.
So what do you want us to write as the rule here as a result? I mean, if you were going to craft our decision, what would you have us?
Well, this court in 1927 in the Mason Tire and Rubber case adopted the Spirin implied warranty of the plans and specifications. There have been at least seven Court of Claims cases that have consistently adopted the implied warranty of the plans and specifications. So I believe that the rule that this court ought to adopt is essentially to restate where we've been since 1927, and that is, consistent with 153.01, when an owner publishes a set of plans and specifications The contractor has the right to rely upon the adequacy and accuracy of those plans and specifications, and where there are defects, the owner has breached the implied warranty of the design. And coming back to Judge Stratton's point, where there is actual and constructive knowledge of the problem, of the delays, of the claim, and the owner can't demonstrate any prejudice, which the owner can't hear, what was OSU going to do differently with this set of problems? 1,000 new drawings, were they going to call a halt to the project? They'd already told the contractors, you will get no time on this project. We don't have time, there will be no time extensions. There was nothing else they could have done but what happened on this project. There was no prejudice. They knew about the design errors as early as September of 1998. And they were consistently advised through schedule updates from then till the end of the job. And going
Council, you would agree, though, that none of the design specifications that needed to be remedied by these 1,000 redrawings were substantial enough to not be able to be remedied. In other words, there was no single error that would have invoked what opposing counsel is saying is the Spearin doctrine, where it has to make the construction an impossibility.
That is an excellent question, and let me answer it this way. Every one of those was an individual impossibility, and if the 10th District's decision is affirmed by this court, what it tells contractors they must do, and let me go back to my example of where you've got a pipe that is interrupted by a structural member. That decision, and this is what we've advised our clients to do, that decision means that when you hit that condition, you shut the job down. It's now impossible for me to continue to perform until you fix that problem, because otherwise the contractor is taking 100% of the financial risk associated with errors in the design. And what does it mean for the standard of care for architects in Ohio? Are they off the hook completely? So every one of those was an individual impossibility. I can't build it until you answer this question, until you come up with a new design. Mm-hmm. So yes, I would disagree with you that there was not one that was unassailable. You can fix any design. All it takes is time and money. And
well, I'm trying to determine where, was this a cumulative, 1,000 paper cuts and you're still injured, or was this one, and is that comparable to a devastating occurrence? I guess that's my...
I think dying by 1,000 cuts is a very good analogy. That's exactly what happened on this project. There were exactly 1,000 supplemental drawings to fix this design. Every one of them took time and resources of the contractor, of all the contractors. We're not just talking about Dugan and Myers. There were two other primes who were plaintiffs here. Every one of those impacted the job, and every one of them was an impossibility until you got that new drawing from the architect. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cups, representing the State of Ohio Administrative Services, and I believe you have an amicus you're going to share.
Yes, Your Honor.
Brief
I'll take 12
with.
Minutes of my time and cede 3 to Mr. Rosati, speaking for the amici who support Ohio State. May it please the Court. Counsel, we certainly agree that this is an important case. In our view, it's an important case because it gives you an opportunity to review the significant remedial provisions in a contract that is in wide use by state agencies and local governments. These remedial provisions have been ignored in this case. The remedial provisions that I'm talking about are sections 6 and 7 dealing with extensions of time and section 8 dealing with dispute resolution, because the situation that you have here is one where the contractor ran past every opportunity that this contract gave the contractor to resolve what are now claimed to be problems and came to the state at the end with a claim that
well,
was not...
Counsel, are you talking about the failure to put in writing the request for extensions?
We're talking about failing to request extensions in a timely fashion.
Let's address that particular portion, because opposing counsel says that the university had to be, blind, deaf, and dumb not to understand that you've got consequences you've got these 1,000 change orders, problems that are presented, drawings that are necessary, and that was a indication that you're going to have delays here.
There are two answers to that. One is factual and one is legal.
Okay.
Let me
address the factual one first. This is not a board created for purposes of litigation. This is a document that existed at the time of contracting. And what it says is that there were 734 RFIs, requests for information, and they were responded to, and Dugan and Myers kept a log to see what the RFIs were doing to its progress. And when they summed them up, the amount of dollars that it cost to deal with the RFIs was zero. That's them speaking, not me. The amount of days of delay that the RFAs caused was full. They were not terminated for 4 days of delay. They were terminated because the project was behind 4 months. So as a factual matter, the RFIs don't seem to have been significant. With respect to the legal piece of the argument, Justice O'Connor, there is an exhibit, and it is the minutes from the project meeting of April 8. It's Dugan and Myers Exhibit 332, and it's in the supplement at 0282. And in that meeting, the architect for Ohio State says, not that there can be no extension, not that extensions will be refused no matter how they are supported, but that they will not be granted unless they are asked for. And indeed, she specifically commits, so it appears from the meeting minutes, to seek extensions on behalf of the contractors if they ask for them in certain areas. So far from being stiff-armed, as they claim, at the last meeting, there was at least an opening. And the reason that is significant is because of exactly what is pointed out in this case by Judge Sadler in the court below. This contract contains, at 6.2, a provision that says that if the contractor is able to make certain showings, most significantly that the causes of the delay are without his fault, the discretion to refuse an extension is shackled. 6.2 says if you make the application and if you make the showing, contractor, and it's not your fault, the owner shall grant an extension, so that the requirement for a written notice is absolutely critical because it allows the owner and the owner's reps to determine what's the assigned cause. Mm-hmm. Is the assigned cause really my plans? The contractor, we're dealing with an experienced contractor here. He understands how this contract works. He understands what 6.2 does for him. And so if the application is not made, mustn't we come to the conclusion that it's not made because he can't make the required showing?
Mm-hmm. Counsel, it sounds so far to me that your view of this is that it's really factual, that you don't dispute the principal assertion by the appellants that if substantial delays are caused by defective design on the part of the architect, that they are entitled to damages for that.
I dispute that with all my heart.
You do?
Justice Pfeiffer. Okay. This case is not about Spirin. This case is about the remedial provisions. No matter what the problem is that the contractor has with the job, no matter who is, quote, at fault, and this contract reads at fault out of the contract, you have to resort to the remedial provisions.
All right, but Judge Clark have all of that in the form of witnesses in front of him during the, 17 days of hearings and determined ruled against the state on that.
Absolutely ruled against the state, and incorrectly so. What he determined was that because there was delay, which he ascribed to the design documents, that was the end of the story. Justice Pfeiffer, that's the beginning of the story. When you have a problem, when you have an RFI, you go to the owner and you say, I need a change order. And that is provided for in 7.1 of this contract. I need a change order, and here's why. So the contractor and the owner reach a change order, they reach a price, they reach terms, and the problem is resolved through the remedial provisions of the contract. And that's what these people did 109 times.
Counsel, before we get down the road to the remedial provisions, I'm interested in what the contractor could have found at the bidding process. When we look at Spirin, we talk about latent defects. What could the contractors have learned on the front end at the bidding process that could have helped them determine whether or not there were there was all this information that was missing?
Judge Moore, the Spirin doctrine, I submit, doesn't focus on the time of bidding, although that seems to be an approach that my opponents have taken. It has to do with what happens in the field. There are two kinds of Spirin cases, plans and specifications cases, and latent or surprising conditions cases. And they both focus on getting the job done. That's what an owner cares about. That's what a contractor cares about. What the contractor knew when he bid this job was that the plans and specs required drawings to be made subsequently. Nobody said you can take these plans and specs and build a building, find out where the pipe goes through the wall. These were plans and specs that complied in every respect with state law, but they required further drawings. They all do. This wasn't a plan for a chicken coop. These are three buildings at The Ohio State University. Of course it requires refinement. But when you get into the field and you do those drawings and you find out that further work is done, or coordination is required, the contractor goes and gets a change order to take care of that problem. They did it 109 times, and every change order was negotiated and contained language that said, if we're paid this amount, it is complete satisfaction of all of the charges that we incur. These clauses make, if they're observed, if they're followed, make construction work. But this contractor says he is entitled to run past them and come at the end and say, I want more money.
How do you answer the statement that counsel makes that you would have done nothing differently had they actually provided you written notice as the contract provides?
I want to put that shoe on the other foot and then answer your question. There were 109 change orders. Not a single request that the contractor made of the owner on this project was rebuffed. This is not a case, like most of the Spirin cases, where the owner has stiff-armed the contractor. All of the change orders brought to the university were honored and a price negotiated and a price paid. $750,000 of extra compensation for the change orders. Here's what the notice clause is for. The notice clause is to flush out the problem of delay when you can do something about it. All of these remedial clauses have one focus. Get the job built. Don't stop. Keep going. Get the towers into the air. The point is that if you are told about delay, as this contract requires, within 10 days of the time the contractor knows he's got a problem, it can be addressed then. What's the word that Shakespeare says? Kill the snake while it's in the egg? Mm-hmm. To get rid of the problem at the front end.
Don't wait until you are, as these people waited, until you are 4 months behind. Time is of the essence of this contract. And by the time it became clear that Dugan and Myers couldn't perform, hadn't performed the coordination that it committed to, it was 4 months of delay. Mm-hmm. So that's what we would have done differently. We would have addressed
it. Counsel, I guess I'm having a little hard time understanding. Did this 4 months sneak up on you? As far as the, wasn't there monitoring by Ohio State to notice they're not where they're supposed to be at this particular, it's the 6 week point, this 8 week point, what's going on here, Dugan, you know?
Justice O'Connor, that's an interesting aspect of this case, because what was bargained for was notice, and what was received was, as my friend Rosati says, anti-notice. Constant reassurances that it's okay, we can catch up, it'll be fine, everything will be terrific. In the last analysis, when you go to the seminal meeting, the April meeting, Ohio State understands that there has been delay and understands that it has been cumulative and is still willing to entertain the idea of extensions if the contractor will come and say, voila, didn't happen.
It is part of the problem, again, back to the facts, these I guess I'm not understanding fully the difference between the 109 change orders and the 1,000 different changes that they speak of. Mm-hmm. I believe I read somewhere that a whole lot of this was drywalling problems all over the building. Well, in the real world, if it's a problem with a drywall in this room or the next room, those are pretty small issues related to one guy who's doing drywall, and you wouldn't anticipate, you wouldn't want a lawyer meeting every time a drywaller says it won't work here.
Justice Pfeiffer, I think you understand this a lot better than you purport to. I'd like to answer you if you promise not to take Mr. Rosati's time
away. I don't know whether that was a compliment or a criticism, but I'll take it as a...
the board that's down here, the 734, RFIs are issued, and some of them, as you point out, deal with trivia, okay? Where do you want the light switch? Do you want a double light switch or do you want a triple light switch? Wouldn't it work better if we had a light switch with four clickers in it to run these? That's an RFI. Okay, you get an answer. That's why when you get to the bottom of the RFIs, it's $0. This, the change orders, that's serious stuff, okay?
And that's the $750,000.
That's why they got $750,000 of extra money, because it's serious stuff. But what they are now, well, my time is up. Let me simply say this.
Finish your thought, because we left him
right. What they are now asking for is they're asking to double up on these change orders, okay? They've been paid for them once. They now want to be paid for them twice. This court has, I respectfully submit, decided this very case before. You decided the substantive issue that is before you with respect to the sanctity of construction contracts when you had Foster Wheeler, and when you said if the contract requires that the contractor turn square corners so that we will have a clear record, then that's what is required.
You think this is then controlled by Foster Wheeler?
Absolutely.
Not Spearin?
Your Honor, my position, and I've said it in my brief and I'm saying it again, is this case doesn't have anything to do with Spearin.
There's no implied warranty here.
It doesn't matter whether there's an implied warranty, because if the contractor is having a problem,
you think it goes to change orders? Think it goes to change orders?
I think it goes to the remedial provisions. Let's assume not an implied warranty, let's assume an express one. The owner says these plans are buildable. Right there in black and white, signs it, signed owner, okay? And you run into construction problems. As long as you have the remedial provisions, They take care of the problem. The genius of construction contracts is to get something built.
So what do you want us to write in this case, then? You want us to just follow Foster Wheeler and say it's already been done, right?
What I would have you, you've decided not only the substantive point, you've provided, 3 months ago, you provided the policy reasons when you decided unanimously in Symantec with Justice Pfeiffer concurring in the result. And that said, we are dealing, when we deal with these public contracts, we're dealing with the people's money. And it's important that that be protected. What I would have you write is the very first proposition of law in my brief, which says in fair substance, a contractor who runs past all the stop signs, all of the remedial provisions in an integrated contract negotiated by people with a parity of bargaining power cannot come at the end and say, forgive me my trespasses, because that truly puts you in a position where what is intended to be a fixed price contract led by competitive bidding turns into a time and materials job where the owner doesn't know what the price is till he gets to the end, and he doesn't know what the delivery date is till he gets to the end. Thank you for giving me the extra time.
Thank you, Mr. Cupps. This is a complex case, and so we are going to run over a little. I allowed Mr. Curry to go over, so we'll allow 2 minutes for the amicus, Jack Rosati.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jack Rosati, and I've been asked by the Ohio Municipal League, the Ohio School Boards Association, the Ohio Association of School Business Officials, and the Buckeye Association of School Administrators to request that this court preserve the integrity of public contract language in this state, preserve the integrity of the public bidding process in this state, and preserve the integrity of the change order process in this state. And the reason those things are so important to my clients is because all of those things are crucial to their ability to manage their budgets. And while the state budget is larger than your typical school district in many municipalities, this proposition of law will be applied to all of them. And it comes into very sharp focus if you're a school district building a project and you have a set budget and limited means for getting additional money. When a contractor says nothing about the plans and specs being defective prior to bidding, even though they have an obligation to do so and allow the owner the opportunity to correct any problems. They say nothing about it after the contracts are executed in a timely manner. Dugan & Myers went a year before they started raising problems with the plans and specifications. They don't
Here, Mr. Cupps has just argued that this is three big buildings. Of course there were going to be elaborations. They should have expected more plans, more detailed plans coming.
Well, Your Honor, I agree that in every large construction case, the contractor submits shop drawings
and
submittals.
So in effect, he's arguing we don't have to turn over all the cards at the opening.
I don't think any contractor expects the plans and specifications to be perfect at the bid time. If they did, then they have no experience in this industry. What's critical, though, in this case, is that they give timely notice, because the owner has many options if timely notice is given. They have the option to change the design. They have the option to sit down with the contractors and say, if these drawings are really that bad, let's negotiate an extension to the contract and take some time to clean them up. They can terminate a contractor for convenience, even though the contractor has no fault, if it's less expensive than having a contractor wait until the end of the project and spring a 7- or 8-figure claim on them. In this case, though, what's really critical is the anti-notice problem. When you have a contractor who is regularly submitting change orders and negotiating time and money for those change orders when they do have problems with the plans and specifications, and they sign a document that says the compensation or time extension provided by this change order constitutes full and complete satisfaction for all direct and indirect costs and interest related thereto, which has been or may be incurred in connection with this change to the work, and the owner pays that change order, they should not be able to come back to the owner without notice during the contract at the tail end of the project and demand more money for the same problems. If this isn't going to compensate them, then they need to object at the time and not accept the change order and not accept the money. And that's the heart of this case. And that's why the school districts are so concerned about this conduct in this case, because they don't have large resources when they're building a project. And when this kind of thing happens, they're dipping into the educational funds and the general funds of the school district.
Your time's up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Curry, take a couple of minutes.
Mr. Curry, would you address the change order compensation language? Because I think that, in my mind at least, is the strongest argument that appellees bring to the court today.
Yes, Justice O'Connor, I'd be happy to. The fact of the matter is that the trial court specifically found that the state had failed to plead accord and satisfaction and that that defense was waived. That finding was never appealed by the state. I don't think it's even properly before this court. That being said, if you look in our papers, the Tierney case, which was decided by the Board of Contract Appeals, clearly said that where you have a multitude of change orders, we recognize it's not possible to account for the cumulative impact of all of these things, so that unless there was specific negotiation of the cumulative impact, we are going to find that it's not covered by this language. In this case, Carol Benkert from Gilbane specifically testified, and this is what Referee Clark relied upon, that the discussion of cumulative impact had been no part of the negotiation of any of these change orders. So
then what's the purpose of a change order with that language in it?
The purpose of the change order is to deal with those costs that are known at that time. A contractor gets change order number one today. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know that he's going to get change orders 2 through 300 over the course of the next several months. What increment of time and cost is it possible to forecast to put into that when you don't know that you're going to be delayed 6 months on this job as a consequence of a multitude of change orders? I understand that the concept is a little muddy, but if you look at the way the boards of contract appeals and the Federal Circuit have dealt with this, who deal with these cases all the time, they have come down just like Tierney repeatedly, that we can't expect the contractor to, in essence, be clairvoyant as to what's going to happen in the future and how it's going to affect the overall impact.
I asked you earlier, you think this is a Spearin case, but your opponent suggests it's either Foster Wheeler or maybe Cementec. Would you care to address their view?
Certainly. Foster Wheeler was a case that was decided on a motion for summary judgment, and I believe that what Foster Wheeler said is that the specific notice provisions will be enforced unless there is a finding by clear and convincing evidence that the owner waived those provisions. That's specifically what Referee Clark found in this case, is that there was a waiver, that there was actual knowledge of all of the impacts on this project, and for that reason he was not willing to enforce the stricture of the claims procedure in the contract. And there are two comments I'd like to make about that. In the first place, every case that's been decided since Spearin, and every case that the Court of Claims has decided on the implied warranty, and every case that this court has decided on the implied warranty, had a change order provision in it. They're in every set of contracts today. The existence of a change order provision or a claims provision does not obviate the fact that when an owner publishes a set of plans and specifications, there's an implied warranty associated with it.
The RFI suggests in the one exhibit that was utilized here that there was virtually 4 days of delay and no cost.
That is one document in a sea of 600 exhibits. Referee Clark heard 17 days of testimony. 15 days were put on by the three prime contractors who were the plaintiffs in this case. He heard 22 witnesses from the prime contractors, four experts, three of whom provided detailed schedule analysis of how these things that occurred on this project impacted the schedule, one who went through in detail how that translated into cost. On the other side, he heard two witnesses, the associate architect who was responsible for this design, if you can even call it that on this project, was not called as a witness. The OSU architect was not called as a witness, and there was no expert testimony. If you recall Referee Clark's opinion, he said three times that there were no expert witnesses called, there was no evidence presented by the state that rebutted any of the claims of design errors and impacts to the project. And under C.E. Morris and Seasons Cole, I think that it's clear that there was evidence to support the trial court's findings.
Thank you very much. To the students, to the lawyers, we don't apologize for letting them go over. They wanted to do that. To the students, if you're late for the next class, tough luck for that teacher, I guess.
<You'll sign
them. laughs> Yeah. Justice O'Connor said she'll sign the note. So we'll be in a brief recess while the students change over and a fresh set of lawyers prepare to bring us the next case. Thank you very much.